good horse, I call you my shiny black bass. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you had taken from somebody else. And this we go riding.
You're listening to episode 597 of Unwelcome Guests, The Psychology of Transition. I'm Robin Upton. And our subtitle this week is Overcoming Millennia of Social Control. It's an attempt to indicate we have a wide-ranging show this week, focusing not so much on the mechanics of social control, but why do people submit to it? What's it going to take to break out of the hierarchical model? All the speakers are familiar to regular listeners of the show, with the exception of one. I thought I'd start with a new speaker. This is Bruce Schneier. At least that's what he's known for. He's been in the news this week because he was due to testify about the security, or otherwise, of the TSA's screening programs. Now, if you're an American, this will be all too familiar, but for non-Americans, there's an agency called the TSA which demands the right, if you travel by air, to grope and or subject you to a cancer-causing screening process. And Bruce Schneier's on the record as saying, look, this is nonsense. This is a security theatre, that's what he calls it, and says it's a money-making business for those people involved, and it's about terrorising people. It's not about keeping anybody safe from terrorists. Now, he was in the news this week. He was due to testify before Congress about the security or otherwise of the TSA screening process, but somebody tapped somebody on the shoulder and he was suddenly uninvited from the list of people who were due to speak. Anyway, this interview is from earlier this year about a conference he'll be speaking at and a book he's written called Liars and Outliers. Now, he talks about Layer 8 and Layer 9. This is nothing too technical. The internet, computers and software are Layers 1 to 7. When he talks about Layer 8, he's talking about computer users. When he talks about Layer 9, he's talking about other agencies which are trying to control users, such as governments or companies, anybody who's issuing policies about what should and shouldn't be done. Now, he is normally quite a technical guy, so I'm encouraged to find such experts looking at the wider picture of what's happening to the technical systems, not looking at the details, looking at their social impact and who it is who wants to be in charge of them.
This is Jean Friedman from RSA Conference. I am very pleased to be speaking with Bruce Schneier, who is once again speaking on a very compelling topic in our industry experts track. His session is titled New Threats to the Internet Infrastructure. So hello, Bruce.
Hey, hi.
Hi. So, Bruce, what are the new threats to the Internet infrastructure that you're going to speak about?
Well, they're not technical. What I'm going to be talking about are, you know, if you know about the IP stack, Layer 8 and Layer 9 attacks. I'm going to talk about economic and political threats. I think in the coming decade, the real threats to the Internet don't come from the bad guys. They don't come from the criminals or the hackers. They come from politics, and they come from economics. And that's really what I want to spend time talking about at RSA this year.
Sounds really interesting. So what do you think some of the political agendas are for the government?
So I have three that I'm talking about. And for the government, I really have two of them. The first one I call ill-conceived regulations from law enforcement. And we're seeing a bunch of this now, that people outside of our community, right, outside the Internet, forcing us to do things in the name of security. And, you know, this is done for a bunch of reasons, right? It's done because people want to be tough on crime, because lobbyists are lobbying for certain kind of regulations on the Internet. And they could be things like data retention laws or Internet kill switch or last fall's SOPA and PIPA debate, right? Regulations in an attempt to appease the media industry. And I think there's enormous risk here because you have people, sometimes even well-meaning, who don't understand what they're doing, yet try to impose regulations. And in the next coming years, I think there's going to be a lot of these, as there's more crime, more terrorism, more organizing for bad people on the internet, and the government wanting to step in and change things. And a lot of them, I think, will make us less secure. So that's the first. The second I worry about is cyber war rhetoric. And by this, I don't mean cyber war itself. I mean government policies that stem from the fear of cyber war. I think right now we are in the early years of a cyber war arms race, that many countries around the world are building cyber war capabilities. And because there's a lot of ignorance and fear as to everyone else's capabilities, countries are assuming the worst and then building on. This is an arms race, and this has the potential to be very destabilizing, very dangerous, and it will have lasting effects on the internet, again, imposed from outside of our community.
Very interesting. So can you provide some examples of where you see the corporate threats are to mold the internet to bolster their business models?
So that's my third. You know, on this talk, I'm going to have three. And I call this third one the rise of big data. By big data, I don't mean large data sets. There's a sort of a technical use of that term. I mean big data as an industry force, like big oil or big tobacco or big pharmaceuticals. There are a lot of companies out there whose business models depend on collecting, aggregating, manipulating, and selling our information. Right? It's data brokers like ChoicePoint, it's internet companies like Google, it's social networking sites like Facebook. I mean, all of these companies are using our data as part of their business models. And these companies are becoming very powerful, and they are lobbying for government changes and technical changes to make their lives easier. And I think in the coming years, we're going to see a huge push by these now very wealthy, very powerful companies to ensure that they have continued access to our data and are able to use it. I mean, a lot of this is going to depend on local laws. The United States is very different than Europe, for example. But big data is changing the internet. Things are moving to the cloud. We're seeing more highly controlled, special-purpose internet appliances like iPads or cameras or game consoles, where people don't have the same freedom to install software that they do on general-purpose computers.
That's really interesting. So do you see any forces that are successfully battling against these threats?
You know, sadly, I don't, and I think that's the problem. You know, the SOPA-PIPA debate last year, the reason the good guys won is not because we blacked out our websites and Wikipedia blacked out. It's because a corporate behemoth like Google got in line against the law. Otherwise, it would have passed. So there are going to be skirmishes within these powerful entities, you know, government and corporate. But rarely does the voice of reason or the technically correct thing to do, rarely does that prevail. You know, I don't see a lot of backstop against these trends. I mean, I'd like that to change. And really, if I have any moral in my talk, it's that we all need to get involved in layers 8 and layers 9. We need to get involved in the politics of what we're doing. It's not enough to be technically correct. We need to be politically prevalent as well.
How do you think we could get people to pull these forces together? Because it's pretty powerful forces going the other way.
I don't know. It might be impossible. I mean, you know, looking at the broader political landscape, in the United States at least, we have a pretty much dysfunctional government, and it seems pretty impossible for the smart thing to be done. So I don't know. I mean, if I had the answer, I'd certainly be doing it. But all I can do right now is point to the problem and say, you know, we need to start doing things here.
I agree with you. So what would you like the audience to most take away from your session?
I think I want the audience to take away context. That as technical people, especially in security, we tend to get lost in the technical minutiae of what we're doing. And that's vitally important, and it's important to get right. But everything we do operates in an economic and a political context. And if we're to get it right, we need to understand those forces and how they're working. Otherwise, you don't stand a chance. So really, I'm hoping people will step back from whatever security thing they're doing and see how it fits into the broader context.
That sounds great. Well, I'm going to ask you about your new book. I know you're unveiling it at the conference. Can you talk a little about that?
Sure. And actually, there's going to be an interview with me about the book. And there's something, I think it's called The Author's Studio. And there'll be a half-hour Q&A. And I think that's on Wednesday. The new book is called Liars and Outliers. And it is an attempt to look at the context of security. And specifically, I'm trying to understand why security exists and how it works. I mean, what is it about our social species that forces us to build security systems? So, you know, very generally, we are a social species. And in order for society to work, we need to trust. And trust is endemic and pervasive all through our society, all of us, every day. And I define this trust very broadly. But of course, in any trusting system, right, in any cooperative system, there is a corresponding uncooperative behavior, right? There's a parasitical behavior on top of it, which is a good survival strategy as long as it's not too powerful. So security is the mechanism by which the group ensures that the few parasites don't get too powerful. So I spend a lot of time talking about these different mechanisms, and a wide variety, right? There are moral mechanisms. We don't steal, not because we'll get arrested, but mostly because we know it's wrong. We feel bad if we do, right? Those are internal moral mechanisms. We also don't steal because if we do, our friends will shun us, right? So there are reputational mechanisms. Of course, those aren't enough, and there are legal mechanisms, and on top of that, there are things like door locks. So I sort of look at this wide variety of effectively security systems that we as a species have developed to allow society to flourish. And then I look at how technology changes these things. Because what's interesting today is not that these security mechanisms are new, but they end up being in new contexts. Right? How does reputation work on Facebook? How do laws work globally? Right? How does morals work when it's someone in a different country I've never met and is just a name on a screen? Then they work differently. And I think that's going to be interesting.
And we're now going to switch from one expert in his field to another. This is Dr. Robert Jensen talking about state violence and violence against women and the way that this is embedded in people's understanding of how the world works. Thanks to Sylvia Richardson of Latin Waves for this interview, and hers is the voice that you'll hear next in this interview from March the 3rd, 2012.
When we think about the way displacement has caused those disadvantaged in society by economic structures, by gender, by racism, by sexism, I'd like to focus primarily on those who are deeply impacted in any society. And I think women seem to be at the bottom of that scale. Someone who has written extensively on the way the state is implicated in perpetuating hierarchies and structures of oppression is my next guest, Dr. Robert Jensen. He's a very well-accomplished author, but one of the areas that I really am excited you write about is the area of feminism. And in your book, Getting Off, you touch on some of these issues. Thank you so much for joining us and for being with us this morning.
Great to be with you, Sylvia.
Now, when you read your book, you immediately are presented with a world that most of us dare not discuss, you know, the world of pornography. And you make the connection how pornography has not only become a way of naturalizing violence, but also racism and inequity. Can you explain why you mean by this?
Sure. Well, first of all, there is a specific genre of media we call pornography, hardcore, sexually explicit, mostly film these days. And my book looks at that particular media genre, but we should recognize that the problem of pornography is not just a specific kind of media, but the way that a pornographic vision of the world is infused in all media, including the mainstream media of pop culture, Hollywood movies, television, network and cable, all of that. And the basic kind of pornographic vision is of women as objectified bodies available for male sexual pleasure. Now, that's not original to pornography. Pornography is not the only vehicle for that ideology, but it's a powerful vehicle today. And the way in which that pornographic idea has spread is very important. Now, the dominant hierarchy, the most central hierarchy in pornography is, of course, men over women, the gender inequality. But as you point out, pornography is also a viciously racist genre. In fact, of all media genre around in North America and the Western world today, it's by far the most overtly racist. It draws on racist stereotypes. It reinforces notions of white supremacy. And these are disturbing realities. Disturbing, as you point out, perhaps more so because the culture seems unable to deal with them honestly. Partly, of course, that's because explicit sex it can be difficult to deal with in a public context. But I think more powerfully, the reason the culture doesn't know how to examine this question is not because of the sexual nature of the media, but because an honest examination of that particular media genre forces us to look at the ways that male dominance, what we might call patriarchy, and white dominance, what we can call white supremacy, are still very much woven into the fabric of how this society operates.
I'm always conscious that none of this happens by accident, that none of us are accidental beings. We are the result of social constructions, of language that, verbalizes and actualizes who we become, how we see the world, the ways in which we interpret the world. Can you speak a little bit about the relationship between this perpetuation of hierarchy, patriarchy, and racial supremacy within the media and the role that this medium plays?
Yeah. Well, first of all, in some sense, you're of course correct that we like to think of ourselves as self-made people, but we're always the product of both what we're trying to become, what we will ourselves to be, and what the society allows us to be and how the society affects us. We're all socialized into a certain way of understanding the world, and that doesn't mean there's only one way of understanding the world, but we're clearly the product of more than just our individual personalities and our individual force of will. On the other hand, there's one way in which some of this is accidental, that is the way the culture constructs, let's say, conceptions of masculinity and femininity, is accidental in the sense that the individuals, let's say, making pornographic films, they're not trying to perpetuate a certain ideology. They're just trying to make a dollar. And in a sexist, patriarchal culture, when the consumer base for your product is men, the easiest way to make money is by appealing to the sexism of that male clientele. And that's kind of accidental in a sense. I mean, it's not what they're after. All they're after is profit. It's a reminder that in a capitalist profit-driven economy, all other values, values of equality and dignity and humanity, are pretty much going to be eliminated in the quest for profit. So there is a kind of accidental nature, but of course it's guided by these ideas of hierarchy. The media are a primary vehicle for that socialization process. We don't want to pretend the media have too much power. After all, the idea of male supremacy or white supremacy didn't originate in contemporary mass media. I think that people sometimes get wrapped up in this question of, well, are the media a cause of these social problems, or do they merely reflect them? And the answer, of course, is yes to both. Media are both a reflection of the society as it exists, but because of the power of the storytelling through mass media, especially through film and television, the media shape and reinforce these ideas as well. So both things are true. And for people who consider themselves progressive, social activists, people involved in movements for justice, the media is not a single focus. Most of us don't obsess only about the media, but we do see the media as part of this larger struggle to create a more just society.
I agree that there is both a causal and symptomatic effect, right, in that it is reflecting the kinds of things that we're producing. I've questioned, though, the naturality that this forms of violence have taken in our society, and I still feel that it's not so innocent. You know, it's not an accidental causing that I see the state implicated in what kinds of things they promote, what kinds of things they tell us we should not participate in. Can you talk a little bit to the state apparatus and the state instruments of particular ways of seeing or creating this kind of instrumental view of the world where, yeah, well, we're just creating capital, and so, you know, these are natural consequences.
There is no question about law, society, culture, economics, in which the state is not involved. After all, the state is the sort of primary organizing principle for contemporary politics, and so state policy, whether it's the assertion of a particular law or policy or the absence of a law or policy, is always implicated. And here again, we should be careful because it is complex. So you're, of course, correct in asserting that when the state creates the context for a capitalist economy and does not impose collective values on corporations, it is helping to create certain things. So the state is responsible in some sense for the proliferation of the hardcore, misogynistic, racist pornography. It has a role in it. But the state is complex. The same U.S. government, for instance, that has been implicated in this spread of misogynist media also passes the Violence Against Women Act, which funds shelters and rape crisis centers. And so there are conflicting values at work here. But then the next step is to say, well, you know, what does the Violence Against Women Act in the United States actually accomplish? It dribbles out a little bit of funding to agencies that basically deal with the consequences of patriarchy and are not really involved in trying to overturn patriarchy. So these are, you know, complex questions. We don't want to be simplistic in the way we approach them, but we also want to recognize that the core question is, are we going to remake society along principles of the inherent dignity of all people and equality? And we've made strides in North America, in the Western world in the last century toward those goals, but we still face incredible impediments. And we've been talking about three different kinds of impediments. One is the structure of the economy, which rewards people who pursue values that have nothing to do with dignity or equality. The nature of the state, which often protects, of course, that economy. And then these underlying cultural understandings of what it means to be a person that are wrapped up in male supremacy and white supremacy, those are harder to dislodge. You can't pass a law to say people shall no longer think of men as naturally dominant to women. So we've got different levels of struggle. Quite frankly, when you put it out on the table that way, it can seem kind of overwhelming because these forces arrayed to support hierarchy, of course, are very powerful. But I think it's very important to be clear about what we're up against because, of course, you can't fashion a strategy to pursue a more just world without understanding what you're up against.
You know, we never really talk about the role of race and gender in determining who holds power within the structures within education. For students, for people who see education as a practice for liberation, as a place to be reflective and imagine a different culture, how do we create that culture within education without first having to address that hierarchy of inequality that already pre-exists and continues to recreate itself?
Well, this is unfortunately very complicated and sometimes quite frankly, very depressing, because let's just take the question of race and step back. In the United States, where I live, there have been enormous improvements in public policy around race in my lifetime. Remember that I was born in 1958. In 1958, the United States was an apartheid society. In most of the states, there was a second-class citizenship, both in law and in practice, for non-white people. Well, that's been eliminated, at least in law. There is equality, at least sort of on the books. And that's an incredible accomplishment. At the same time, we can see that the opportunities for non-white people who might have had a different view of how to structure society from the dominant white population, that their access to privilege and power, their ability to become a university professor or to become a politician or a business owner, is really typically dependent on their willingness to accept the hierarchical structure of society. And so Barack Obama is president of the United States, but he's president of the United States, an African-American man, by virtue of his signaling to the dominant power structure that he will not challenge that. Now, that's not to beat up on Barack Obama. It's just to observe something pretty obvious. You know, Clarence Thomas is on the U.S. Supreme Court, and he's right now probably the most right-wing reactionary member of that Supreme Court. His access to power and privilege has been accomplished in part by signaling his willingness to accept that hierarchy. So at every institution where we're trying to make changes, we're going to find that the people who have access to power and privilege are unfortunately going to often be the most compromised. But on the other hand, nothing is complete. Nothing is that simple. So I work at the University of Texas, a large state-supported research institution that's not committed to progressive values. It's committed to hierarchy. But within that university, there's all sorts of people who are attempting subversive activities, you know, trying to undermine hierarchy. And so your question, it took a long time to build up to answering your question, in part because your question doesn't, of course, have a simple answer. But we try to create spaces where we have some ability to do that, to foster critique, to foster subversion, basically. I try and do that in the classroom. Lots of people try and do it through administrative ways. It's not the end of the answer. You know, we still have to deal with these larger structures. Take education, for instance. Lots of people are trying to do creative things within the school system in the United States, the public school system. I know some of these folks. They're friends of mine who are teachers who are doing really great work. But they still, at the end of the semester, have to administer the standardized test, the hierarchical imposition of these ridiculous standardized tests to judge knowledge. And therefore, their teaching has to accommodate that. So both things are true. They're given a certain amount of freedom to challenge, and in the end, they're also subordinated to this system of ridiculous testing. And so, you know, we make inroads where we can. We both try to work in very small ways on the ground, locally where we are, and we try and keep an eye on the bigger picture. You know, this is not a revolutionary moment in history, at least not in the United States or in Canada. It doesn't look like there's going to be massive social change toward a more progressive, just, and decent society in the near future. So that doesn't mean we give up. It just means we work where it appears there is a likelihood of advancing the cause, realizing it's a long-term struggle. I know that doesn't, you know, provide a strategy necessarily, but it does, I think, provide a kind of principle that can help guide us as we try and make decisions.
Pornography not only debases women, but also debases men, as, you know, it prescribes a kind of way of being male that doesn't tell the whole story. So I think that's one of the ways that we challenge those structures is by challenging how we think and act and be within that structure. And I think that we change those spaces just as much as they change us, right? So tell me, what inspires you to envision, and how do you envision male feminists participating in the struggle against violence against women?
Well, of course, every liberation movement that exists where people who are on the bottom of a hierarchy are challenging that hierarchy, every one of those movements provides an opportunity for people with unearned privilege and power to contribute. Feminism allows space for men to do that. Critical race movements allow space for white people. So, you know, sometimes those of us with privilege, we try to justify our inaction by saying, well, there's no place for me to contribute, but of course there is. And one of the reasons that might motivate people in positions of power and privilege to do that, as you point out, is to recognize that even though these systems of hierarchy do give us certain kinds of goodies, you know, especially short-term material kind of rewards, that we lose something in the process. The main thing we lose, of course, is our own humanity. To hold on to unearned privilege and power and really believe you have a right to it is to give up some of your own humanity. Now, when we say that there's something in it for people with privilege and power to resist hierarchy, we don't want to be, you know, naive. There are powerful forces that keep people locked into support for those systems. But I think we do have to talk openly and honestly, especially those of us who have tried to make a contribution to movements that there is a reward in it. We don't want to pretend that the only reason people act is out of selfishness, but you know, that is part of who we are as human beings. We respond to our own self-interest. And so one way to think about this is how to redefine self-interest for people in positions of unearned privilege and power. One writer used to describe this as changing from an idea of self-interest to an idea of what is in the interest of your best self. That is, how do you aspire to be something more than you are? And I think when we look honestly at that, those of us in these positions of unearned privilege and power, the answer to that question, how do we become our best self, is by trying to, with the resources we have, contribute to movements to challenge hierarchy, authority, domination. And that's been not just a theory for me and for people I've worked with. It's been a real-life experience. I've spent about the last 20 years now actively involved in these kind of political movements. And I can tell you without question, I'm a happier, healthier human being today than I was 30 years ago when I was not thinking about these things and not politically active. So those of us who have engaged in these kind of struggles, especially, for instance, men who've tried to challenge the various forms of sexual exploitation of women in the culture, we need to be willing to speak about that. Not, you know, to say, look at me, I'm such a great guy, everybody should love me because I'm a man who's committed to feminism, but to model some sort of alternative. Because most men walk through their lives with absolutely no model of what it would be to challenge the conventional notions of masculinity. I know growing up, I certainly had no models. I didn't see anybody who was talking about feminism. I didn't see any men who were saying, listen, you can reject this toxic conception of masculinity. So I think it's incumbent on us to talk, not arrogantly, and certainly not to self-aggrandize, but just to be honest about what is possible in this world.
You contribute to a magazine called Common Dreams, and you know, I love the name because I think that although there is this, it's the differences that we are fighting for, right? To recognize that although we're not the same, and we have never been the same, we all have different barriers, that we can work towards things that we have in common, that, you know, things that make us all move towards what's in the best interest of my best selves, as you just said, which I thought was beautiful. So what ought to be, you know, our common dream for citizenry, for instance? As teachers, we are implicated in either silencing or being part of creating spaces for unheard voices to come forth. Where do you see the spaces that we need to be working towards? Many of us are denied spaces within our classrooms because our teachers are fearful. How do you overcome that fear, and what are the opportunities?
Well, first of all, to ask what are our common dreams is actually a pretty simple question if we take seriously our own moral and theological systems. You know, everybody in this world claims some sort of moral, whether it's a secular moral or a religiously inspired moral system. And the interesting thing is, for all of the differences among those moral systems, and of course there are differences, but there are some pretty core ideas that animate all these systems. And the one that's most obvious is what is sometimes called the ethic of reciprocity, the idea that you fashion a system to live in which you wouldn't impose on others things you would not want imposed on yourselves. In the Christian tradition, we call this the golden rule, do unto others as you would want them to do unto you. But there's some version of that in every system you can find. Well, if we actually took that seriously, we would certainly want to work toward a world in which people are not living in abject poverty, as about half the world's population is. We would certainly try to fashion a world in which the ability of a nation state to amass military power wouldn't be the basis for the privileges of some and the suffering of others. I mean, all of these things are pretty straightforward. We just have to take our own moral principles seriously. Now, in a world structured on hierarchy, of course, there's a lot of impediments to that, and I think the place to do that most effectively is in the smallest places where we live and work, that is, at the level of the local, the grassroots. I'm not saying there isn't an important role for national and international movements, But when you ask the question, how do we sort of start to live a different way? Well, we do that in the places where we live. That might be, you know, trying to commit to a more democratic workplace where you actually fashion rules to let people control their own work. In a church, it might be taking seriously the moral precepts of the faith and trying to make that central in the life of the church rather than sort of sterile rituals or, you know, chanting the right doctrines or something like that. In political organizing, it means, I think, paying attention to our personal relationships as we go about the business of trying to pursue public policy, for instance, you know, creating spaces where people not only try to achieve results, you know, getting a law passed or, you know, getting a policy changed, but also treat each other with dignity and respect. You know, that's long been understood in political theory, that if you're trying to bring into existence a new world, the process by which you bring that world into existence has to model the best way we want to interact. That doesn't mean people aren't strategic and don't make compromises now and then, but at a very basic level, those of us who are white, those of us who are male, those of us who are economically privileged, and I happen to be in all three of those categories, we have to model behavior that takes seriously democracy and equality, which means we can't hold on to the power and privilege we have in those progressive spaces where we claim we're trying to make changes. We can't, you know, kind of hold out our trump card of, you know, whiteness or maleness or economic resources. We really do have to commit to something else. Now, I've been extremely fortunate to be part of activities in Austin, Texas, where I live, with women, with people of color, with you know, immigrant workers, people on low income, where we're creating spaces to try and do that. It's not easy. It's a struggle. I find that every day I have to remind myself that I do have this privilege and I better think about how to contribute to the group rather than just make myself feel good. It's a struggle. And some people say, well, I get tired of that struggle. But my own experience is that struggle is what has made my own life meaningful. I do it not just because I think it's the right thing to do, but because at the end of the day, no matter how tired I am, I have a sense that I have, you know, again, tried to become my best self. And that may be a rather intangible, you know, sort of reward. But for those of us, I think, who can speak to this, the first thing we would say is it's a very real reward. And it is, in fact, I think, what motivates the people throughout history, as we look back at people who have been able to maintain a commitment to this kind of radical political organizing. It has been the reward that motivated them as well.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is Dr. Robert Jensen. He's the author of many books. How can people access your work?
The easiest way is just to put my name into a search engine, Robert Jensen, and the first page that comes up will be my page at the university with a lot of articles and other references people might find interesting.
Well, the idea of trying to be one's best self strikes a chord with me. It fits neatly into the idea of altruistic economics. Why does business have to be selfish and hard-nosed? If business is providing things for other people, couldn't it be focused in an altruistic way? I hope we're going to have time in a couple of episodes to look in more detail at some of the models that I've proposed and how they chime with other alternative economic thinkers. And now we're going to hear an interview. This is back from 2009 from the Agro Innovations podcast. Thank you to Frank for this. This is with Rob Hopkins, founder of the Transition Movement, one of the most successful grassroots resistance movements of recent years, I think primarily because it has a positive outlook. It doesn't focus on the dangers, the evils of climate change. It looks at how would we like the world to be and how do we get there. Prominently lacking from commercially controlled media, newspapers, television don't take this approach. Let's hear Rob Hopkins.
We are joined by Rob Hopkins. Rob is a permaculture practitioner and teacher and author of many books, including The Transition Handbook, From Oil Dependence to Local Resilience, and also the founder of the Transition Network. Rob also blogs at transitionculture.org. Rob Hopkins, welcome to the Agro-Innovations Podcast.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Tell us about your background before your involvement in the transition culture movement.
Well, I spent many years as a permaculture teacher and designer, involved in eco-village development. So a lot of what I did when I lived in Ireland was based around trying to get planning permission and develop one of the first eco-village projects in Ireland, which we did. So I have a lot of background in straw bale building and cob building, gardening, that kind of thing. So one of the things that I was involved in when I was in Ireland was setting up the first two-year full-time permaculture course in the world, I think, which also taught alongside permaculture design, woodland, there was woodland management, sustainable building, that kind of stuff. So eclectic, I'd say.
Now, what are the origins of the transition culture?
Well, the transition idea came around, started forming, I suppose, in around 2004, when I was teaching permaculture at a college in Ireland, and I found out about peak oil. And I started to, I got my second year students to do a project where they looked at the town of Kinsale, where the course was, and tried to design, using permaculture principles, a pathway away from oil dependency for the town. And we spent a long time looking around the world thinking, somebody else must have thought about this. Somebody else must be on the case with this already. And we couldn't find anybody who'd even started thinking about it, really, in any sort of tangible way. So the project that they did was just trying to look across food, energy, housing, building, what that move away from oil dependency might look like if it was based on the idea that you start with a vision of how you'd like it to be and then you backcast as to how you would actually get there. And the resultant plan was something that became quite viral on the internet, and it was lots and lots of places started getting rather excited about it. And then later that year, I then moved back to the UK, which is where I was from originally, to Totnes in Devon, and then that was when we started an initiative here that wasn't called Transition Town Totnes to start with, but after a year or so we started to call it that. And really that was when we started to design the model. And I think really for me it's like what transition is. It's a bit like how in music, you know, a lot of the most exciting innovations in music come when people think, what happens if you put this with this? You know, what happens if you put that kind of music over the beat from that kind of music? You get a whole new genre of music. And so for me, really, where transition emerged from was trying to design a response to peak oil using permaculture principles.
In the process of developing this, you have articulated a 12-step approach. What is this 12-step approach? And how exactly does it work?
Well, it's there are 12 of them largely by accident, but actually I quite like the thing that it's like an addictions model, because our relationship with fossil fuels in the West is such an addictive and such a dependent relationship. But that came about because after we'd been doing stuff here in Totnes for a while, we got people from other communities getting in touch saying, what are you doing and how do you do that exactly? And we had no idea really, because we had very much made it up spontaneously on the hoof as we'd gone along, really. And it was a kind of a distilling of very eclectic inspirations from psychology and environmental activism and a whole range of different disciplines. So we started just pulling together what some of those ingredients were that underpinned it, based on what we've been doing in Totnes. So the first one is forming a steering group and designing its demise from the outset, which is based on the idea of trying to get away from groups just getting stuck in the fact that they're a group, but that it actually designs for its own evolution as the process goes along. And then it moves into awareness raising, and a lot of transition groups spend their first year or so doing a lot of awareness raising, because really what transition groups act as is a catalyst. It's not a process that comes in with all of the ideas already in a little bag and sort of and takes them all out. It's really a process which is about catalyzing the community to design its own response. So that awareness raising stage is really, really important. Then there's all around laying the foundations about networking with other organizations that are already there, because it's, you know, the chances are you're not going to be the first organization that ever thought a green thought in the history of the town. Then there's having what we call an unleashing, which is the kind of the launch event. It's designed to be a celebration of the place and of the local culture, and in such a way that designed to be the evening people will look back to historically as the point where it all began. Then groups start to form around specific subjects like energy and housing, and that brings out the people who are really passionate about that subject, because transition is designed to be a process driven not by guilt and despair and angst, but rather to be driven by what it is that people are really passionate about and what really fires them up. Then it moves through things like using open space, which is a really good way of getting large groups of people together to brainstorm collectively, starting practical projects going, so it doesn't just remain as a sort of theoretical thing, but it actually starts to have manifestations. Reskilling people, we use this term of great reskilling, because I think we have become the most useless generation in history in terms of skills. Starting to work with your local government, which lots of transition groups are doing very effectively around the country. Honouring the elders, as in we do quite a lot of work around oral history, which I think is really important, that thing of looking backwards as well as looking forwards. Then there's let it go where it wants to go, which is really when you start this process, you have no idea where it's going to go and what you're going to end up with. And so designing into the flexibility to be open to what the people who actually start driving it forward want to do is really important. And then the last one, the 12th step, is about creating an energy descent plan. And to go back to permaculture terms, I think really what a transition project is a community design project. So it's basically the design of how this place could be in a lower energy future. And then an energy descent plan is in effect your design document. So it's a plan B for the settlement, which looks at food, energy, housing, education, medicine, a whole range of different things, through that lens of what could it be like here if we embrace this as an opportunity, and how are we going to get there?
What are some of the pitfalls that you want, if someone's listening to this and saying, that's a great idea, I really want to start doing that, and I want to look more into the 12 steps, or perhaps they've already gotten started. Now, I'm sure you've seen this process in its different stages in various different contexts. What are some of the pitfalls that come up again and again, and what do you think people need to be aware of as they go into this process, or if they're already into this process, so they can help smooth those pitfalls over a little bit?
I think some of the pitfalls revolve around whether people have any experience of working in groups with other people. We've become such an individualistic society that actually a lot of the skills about just listening and being considerate of other people's opinion and actually just working with other people are things that we've lost. Although they're eminently learnable skills. So in the transition training that we've developed, you know, there are certain things that are very important trainings you can get at them quite early on in the process, which can make an enormous difference. There are issues sometimes around finance, about the fact that these initiatives are driven purely by volunteers. But my sense is that you know, money is never a substitute for enthusiasm. And you'd rather have volunteer enthusiasm any day than money, because you just can't buy that. But you do often kind of reach a point in the process where actually money is going to be very useful. So funding for this kind of thing is very useful. Other kind of pitfalls, I suppose, is burnout as well. You know, sometimes people, you know, a lot of people do this in their spare time around having a job as well. And so one of the sort of antidotes for that, I think, is designing into the process. It's something which environmentalists have been terrible at for a long time, I think, which is designing into the process time to celebrate and acknowledge what everyone's been doing, really. I mean, if the process isn't fun, and it doesn't feel historic, then we're doing something wrong, I think. And I think in the best examples we see of transition around the place, you know, there really is that sense of people collectively making history together, which is how it should feel.
Now, do you feel that some of the things that you described as pitfalls, one of the things that I feel personally is that one of the great outcomes of this could potentially be, you know, business models for small businesses, small entrepreneurs or community-based organizations or cooperatives, what have you, local trusteeships, where actually by providing a valuable product or service to the community or to the larger region, some money can actually start to flow through that organization as it provides a service that is useful in the transition. What are your thoughts about that as being a good way to maybe mitigate some of the effects of these pitfalls?
I think one of the things that's going to be the key over the next 10 or 15 years is the ability of communities to invest money into themselves. And the relocalization process isn't going to come around by accident. It takes a lot of intentional design, but it also takes the creation of the institutions who are able to do that. And so whether transition initiatives themselves in effect become a relocalization agency, become a social enterprise which is dedicated to funding and enabling and creating livelihoods from the process of relocalization, or whether the role of the transition initiative is to inspire and train other people to do that, isn't clear yet, and I imagine will be different in different places. But I think the social enterprise model brings a lot to transition in terms of transition initiatives being able to stand on their own feet financially. And that's, I think, where the movement is at now, really, is looking. That's one of the things that's really being looked at in detail is how do we make that step across and you know, work with business, work with local government, and actually become acquire the appropriate skills and the appropriate models to enable that.
Well, I'm sure you're familiar with the work of Woody Tash and the Slow Money Institute.
Yeah.
They are talking about very similar things. Now, let me ask you what you mentioned in the 12-step approach. I believe the final step is energy distent action planning. Can you talk a little bit about that and what that is?
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, it's something that the first version, the thing that we did in Kinsale, was very much a kind of student project, and we made it up as we went along, and we really didn't have a model to work from. Over the last year and a half here in Totnes in Devon, so Totnes is the first transition initiative in the UK, and so we're the first ones who've reached that stage of trying to do an energy descent plan. So as I said before, it's really something which is based around a community visioning process, based on assumptions around peak oil and climate change. You know, it's not just an open thing that says, hey, everybody, what would you like Totnes to be like in 20 years' time? You know, and people would come up with, well, we want to have hoverboards, and we want to have a McDonald's everywhere, and we want to be able to fly to the moon on holiday. You know, it's really based within the parameters around peak oil and climate change and saying, you know, we need to design a way through that. You know, so it's setting a question, it's setting a challenge to the community. How are we going to adapt and thrive in response to this particular challenge? And then there's the process that we ran was lots of community workshops on different themes, different subjects, starting with visioning and then working backwards in terms of how we're actually going to get there, involving lots of local organizations, artists, school children. It also contained some quite powerful research. So we have some research that we did called Can Totnes and District Feed Itself, which was an attempt to quantify the degree to which the area would be able to meet its own food and fuel needs from its surrounding land. We have an energy budget for the area as well, which nobody had ever done before, and the degree to which renewables could meet local demands. And we did a survey as well of 230 houses in the area as a way of establishing opinions on all of these different things. And We've also developed what we call resilience indicators, which nobody has ever done before, which is a way of measuring the degree to which the community is moving towards the resilience that we're talking about. And in many ways, the way we think of an energy descent plan is a story. It's not as though the community is going to pick it up and work through the timeline in it step by step by step by step. Although hopefully, you know, some of that will come to pass. But really what it does is it tells a story of how the community could do it, which will in turn engage and stimulate, hopefully, the community to, you know, to get involved and add bits to that story.
There's a book that Charles Eisenstein has written called The Ascent of Humanity. Are you familiar with Charles Eisenstein's work?
No, I'm not. No.
Well, let me read to you a quote from that book. Charles Eisenstein writes, "Like an alcoholic whose resources of goodwill, money, pawnable assets, friends, and credibility are almost exhausted, our way of life is on the verge of collapse. We continue to scramble, applying new technological fixes at greater and greater cost to alleviate the problems caused by the last fixed. The addict will keep on using until life becomes completely unmanageable. Ecological awareness, localism, green design, herbalism, community currencies, ecology-based economies are all like the drunk's moment of clarity on the way down. They will not so much save us as serve as the seeds for a new way of living and being that we will adopt after the collapse. Indeed, they will all come naturally as a matter of course, if there is anything left at all." What is your response to Eisenstein's characterization of something like the transition culture as the moment of clarity of an alcoholic culture?
That's a very nice quote. The only thing that I would disagree with that is there's a very interesting debate that's been happening on the website that I do around a piece that Alex Stefan at World Changing wrote recently around this notion of this interpretation of collapse and the inevitability of collapse. You know, that there are some people who come from a perspective of looking at peak oil and climate change who argue that an impending severe collapse is an inevitability. And there are others like myself who would argue that actually what we're talking about is energy descent. This term energy descent is really important, I think, because it's about, if you imagine the petroleum age, the fossil fuel age, as being like a mountain that we currently stand on the top of, I think what we're designing for is that actually collapse is always a possibility. It's like the ghost of Christmas future from A Christmas Carol. You know, it's something that could come to pass, but not necessarily. And my sense is that if we can apply our common sense and creativity and passion, actually we can design an energy descent. We can design a positive and productive way back down the mountain, towards a path of contraction, towards a path of some more simplicity, more localization. But it doesn't have to be, actually, if you're dealing with somebody who is an alcoholic and who is a drinker, sometimes what gets people out of being an alcoholic is waking up in the gutter and all their family have abandoned them and, in effect, their life has collapsed. But actually, some people can actually pull out of it sooner than that and don't need such an extreme situation. And so the only thing that I would disagree with him, I think that it's actually a case that, yes, that things like localism are the things that the culture will turn to and embrace because they will see that that's where the future is, and that's where, and it actually ultimately is what makes people happier. And although we've had economic growth for the last however many years, it hasn't been accompanied by social growth. You know, economic growth hasn't been accompanied by people feeling more skilled, more happier, more relaxed, more connected with other people.